Good, great. Well, look, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. Really excited, all that kind of stuff. Like I said, I think you're doing a series, is that right, on change makers or something? Is that correct? So I'm going to do the church is a change maker. It has a biblical mandate. Ephesians actually says that God, through his manifold wisdom, chose to make known his will through the church. So weirdly, God set up this thing called the church, and that's his agent of change that he wants to use through the world. Just stand up for a second. I'm just going to embarrass everyone here. I'm just going to ask a question. So, sorry, guys, you've got comfortable. Everyone just stand up for a sec. I'm guessing most of you have been in church a fair wodge of time. Is that fair? How many here would have been to Sunday school quite regularly as youngsters? Okay, great. So I'm just going to ask you a question. Have you, I don't want to embarrass anyone who hasn't, so shut your eyes. Have you heard of the story of the feeding of the 5,000? Just put your hand up. Great. Most of you have. It doesn't matter if you haven't. Okay, you can put your hands down and open your eyes. And very quickly, someone, Brightspark, who fed the 5,000? Just to see if any of you have taken anything in your... Who fed the 5,000? Okay, anyway, Jesus. Everyone agree? Okay, great. Well done. You've learned something in your church history. That's fantastic. Sit down and job done. Okay. So when I was kind of your age, I kind of... or lie down, yeah. I can remember kind of going through this phase when I was younger thinking... the feeding the 5,000, all these things I learned in Sunday school, they're lovely stories, a bit like fairy tales. And, you know, I enjoyed Hansel and Gretel, I enjoyed feeding the 5,000. I couldn't quite get my head round, A, its relevance, and B, did it actually happen like that. Now, sort of 20 years on, I find the feeding the 5,000 weirdly the most inspiring story for me, one of the most inspiring stories in the Bible. And I find what Jesus said in it, A, both incredibly relevant to today, and B, highly incisive. So we're going to try and go through that. Have we got a PowerPoint going up? We're going to get a PowerPoint. So picture the scene. Jesus rocks up. He's actually in the disciples. He's actually had a tough day because John the Baptist got his head chopped off. He's feeling pretty upset about that. He must have been wondering, why on earth people are following me? Is it really worth it? Because this dude's lost his head. Now he's a really great guy. And he takes his disciples away for a rest, for a retreat. And there we are. That's a bit, yeah. If anyone wants to contact me, you can... I don't really do anything other than Facebook or email, but you can contact me on that. So Jesus, he's there, and he's got 5,000 people in front of him, and the key thing that Jesus is responding to that, I'd have felt tired, I'd have felt grumpy, I'd have wanted to get away from them all. Jesus looked at this crowd, and these probably wouldn't have been the intellectual intelligentsia, they probably wouldn't have been the high flyers, they'd probably been the kind of loafers of society, and he looked on the crowd, and he had compassion. And that's the first thing about Jesus and first thing about all of us is that actually as we look out there, we look into the world, as we grow in Christ, as we grow in our faith, as we spend time developing in prayer and developing our time with God, then our heart for our neighbor has to increase the whole time. He kind of said, well, what are we going to do about these 5,000 people? And his disciples... said something really logical that was really common sense. And they said, well, we can't do anything about it. Send the crowds away. Send the crowds away. Now, if you like, the disciples are the church. They are the fledgling church. You've got the needy, hungry masses here, and you've got the church there. And the church made a really logical, common sense statement and said, get rid of those people. Send them out to the towns and the villages. A few years ago, I was just sitting outside of a cathedral, not Peterborough Cathedral, and I was having lunch on a kind of, if you can imagine, a green outside it, and I saw a couple who are homeless walk into the cathedral. And whenever I see a couple who are homeless, I always kind of think of Mary and Joseph, who are a couple and homeless. And they walked into the cathedral, and they asked to come in, and they were told, no, you can't come in. And they asked again, and they were told, no, they can't come in. And eventually, a dude in a dog collar, like a vicar, a guy, came to the front and said, no, go away. Go to the council. And he spoke like that. And I kind of watched all this. And eventually, this couple trudged off. and I knew where the council was in this town and city, so I kind of bought them some food and showed them the way to the council. But what that vicar was doing was exactly what the early disciples did. Is he was saying, send them away. We can't handle them. Send away the crowds to the towns and villages. And what we say at Hope into Action, which I'll come on to, is no, we don't think it's the job of the council. We don't think it's the job of charities. We think it's the role of church to actually care for the poor. So that's the first thing he says. Then he says... as we all know, right, let's give these dudes something to eat. And all the disciples says, we can't give them anything to eat. We haven't got anything. And then Jesus says this, three words, go and see. Go and see what you have. Go and see what's out there. What have you got that you can feed these people with? It's a really incisive question that he could ask every single person in this room. What have you got? Go and see. Do an inventory of your life. What can you do for the poorest that are right in front of you? Some bloke says, well, it would require 8 months of our wages to feed this lot. And then Andrew, who I really love, says this. He says, here's a small boy, as we know, with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And what I love is, he then says, but how far will that go? I love that because he expressed his doubts to Jesus. He said, I've got something. It feels really inadequate compared to the huge need out there. I'm going to bring it to Jesus, but I'm full of doubts as I do that. And how far will it go? So we can bring our doubts to Jesus. We can bring what little we've got to Jesus. And as we know then, Jesus broke that bread and he shoved it all around there. So this thing happened because of the faith of a young person. This dude who had 5 loaves, he's probably quite fat if you think about it, or quite large, because to eat 5 loaves is quite a lot of money, quite a lot of food. And he brought it to Jesus, and Jesus, we know, fed 5,000 people. So this is the way I see this happening. I absolutely believe, which I didn't kind of for a while, I absolutely believe that Jesus literally broke that bread for 5,000 times, and that fed 5,000 people. But I don't believe that that young person was the only one with food of that 5,000. Humans just don't like work like that. I don't believe that all of them left home forgetting about food. I don't believe any mother would send their kid out without the lunchbox. And I don't think they would have done 2,000 years ago either. So I think what also happened, as well as Jesus breaking this bread, he got them sitting down, people said, oh, I've got a cheeky Mars bar. Why don't we share this as well? I've got a nice falafel. Why don't we have this as well? And so this great big feast kind of happened because this one boy shared his bread. So you had both the miracle and you kind of had people being generous on the back of it. But here is the thing. Jesus did not feed the 5,000 people. Jesus did not feed them. Who fed them? No. No. The disciples. Jesus gave the bread to the disciples and the disciples fed the guys. Remember, the disciples represent the early church. So this concept that we can sometimes have as Christians, Lord, pray, I really see that need there. Lord, can you just zap that person and sort it out? I don't think God's going to answer that prayer. God doesn't work like that, in my view. I think God works through us and he works through the church. These 12 people here fed 5,000 people. Now, just pause on that point for a sec. Who here has ever fed 5,000 people? Who here has ever fed... Anyone ever been a waiter or a waitress? It's hard work, right? When I used to work overseas, I worked in northern Kenya in a famine situation, and we went to this place called Kargi, and we had 180 kids who were what you call acutely malnourished, and we had to feed them every week. And it was so tiring that we got our entire team up, and I would sit there, and my job would be just to wadge out all the food into little baskets for these mothers. And I tell you, this is about 40 degree heat or 50 degree heat. It was so exhausting that after the end of that day, we could do nothing but just sit around and just drink Coke just to get some energy back into us. We were so exhausted. That's for 180 people. If what is 5,000 divided by 12? It's roughly 400, 450. So roughly each disciple had to feed 400 people. That is exhausting work. And there's a verse in the Old Testament that says, isn't this the kind of worship I'm after? To spend yourself on behalf of the hungry. Those disciples would have been spent at the end of that. following Jesus can be hard work. He doesn't do the work. He works through us. He provides us with the stuff, but he works through the church to meet the need. Once they'd finished, what did Jesus do? Go on. Yeah, good. Clip to the left. So you can learn from that. Don't ever waste stuff. He didn't waste any food. After that, well, that's pretty knackering, clearing up, exhausting. Then he shoves them on a boat and says, now just row through the night. This is like a ultra marathon that he's got these guys, or ultra triathlon he's got these guys. So following Jesus is hard work, if you kind of empathize with that. So that's the feeding the 5,000. Everyone got that? Everyone kind of know where we are? And you'll see this is a template of how Jesus wants the early church to work. He wants the early church to kind of be his hands and feet, to outwork his love and compassion for those who are without. In John's gospel, what are his dying words on the cross? Anyone know? Yeah, they're all said. Not the right answer. His dying words on the cross in John's gospel was, that is my mother. She is now without her child. So given that Joseph had died, in that culture, the man, the eldest son, would look after the mother. She is, if you like, a vulnerable lady now. She's arguably homeless. John, will you please look after her? And then it says, and John took her into his home. Jesus is gone now. John, representing the church, his first thing he did was he took into his home a vulnerable lady. Yeah. So, again, you're seeing this idea of the church, if you like, housing the homeless, from its very roots, from its absolute core. Just going to talk a little bit about Hope Interaction, where I work now. So Hope Interaction, sometimes when I explain Hope Interaction, I explain about meeting the need on the streets. If you like, if you remember, Jesus had compassion on the crowds. At the moment, on Thursday, the Mirror devoted 11 pages to homelessness in this country. It's a massive and growing a problem. You've probably seen it anecdotally as you walk around the streets. I can tell you statistically it's increased by 165% in the last 8 or 9 years. It's a massive problem. When someone is homeless, it's a tragic situation for them to be in. It's growing, it's tragic, it's pulsating. 10 years ago, I met a guy who was sitting on a bench. You've all seen them many times. He kind of looked like a tramp, but he was kind of clean shaven, so it didn't kind of make sense. And I got speaking to him, and I said, so what's your story, and where have you come from, and how did you get here? And his story was this. He'd left prison that morning, he had nowhere to go, and nowhere to go to. At the point of walking out the prison gates, he kind of said, you know what, I really want to make a fresh start of my life, I really want to have a good go at this, I don't want to come back here. As he was walking through the prison gates, a prison officer said to him, we'll see you back here in 3 months' time. That crumbled any self-esteem he had, his hope dwindled, and you get given 47 quid when you leave the prison. He had nowhere to go, no one to go to, and so by the time I met him at 11 a.m. in the morning, he'd already drunk half a bottle of gin. Actually, he'd made a fairly rational choice, because who else was he supposed to go to? If you have no one to go to, there's a relational poverty in your life, and that's the root cause of your physical poverty, having nowhere to go to. Does that make sense? So if I came out of prison tomorrow, I've got a wife, she said she'd take me back, I've got parents, I've got brother and sister, I've got a relational richness that prevents me from being homeless. Right? When someone is homeless, they have a relational poverty, and that's what needs dealing with. Everyone with me? Just before Christmas, I went into the prison again. I met a lady. True story. This isn't the only form of homelessness, but this is another true story. And part of the reason I went in is because I wanted to stay connected to the need on the streets. I wanted to feel what's going on, and I wanted to hear from Jesus, because Jesus speaks to us through prisoners. That's what he says in Matthew 25. So I went in. Her story is this. She'd been in 6-7 weeks, not long. She'd been beaten up. She walked into the prison cell. I'm in a waiting room for her. She walks in and she's in tears straight away. I'm like, goodness me, what's going on here? She's sobbing. Her snot is coming out of her nose. It's embarrassing for her. It's embarrassing for me. I'm a bloke. I don't know how to deal with crying girls very well. So I kind of had to deal with this situation. And she was like, within 2-5 minutes, she was telling me 18 months ago, her boyfriend had beaten her up so badly, and she kept saying, it's my fault, it's my fault. I said, it's not your fault that this man beat you up. It doesn't matter what you've done, it is never your fault if he beats you up. And it turns out he'd beaten her up so badly, she needed to be airlifted out of where she was to London, and the medics reckon she died for about four seconds. So basically, he as good as killed her this is his boyfriend. When she came to and when she woke up, she realized she'd been raped by him, and the evidence of that rape was all over her body. And she's like, you know, and 18 months on, she's still so traumatized by this rape and this beating up. This guy that she loved had nearly virtually killed her. And she just kept repeating the stories and stories and stories. And I was like, man, this is difficult. I don't, you know, what do you say? So I was, blah, blah, blah. I did my best. She was coming out in 6 days' time. And I was like, right, I'll find you somewhere to live. I'm determined to find you somewhere to live. Hoping to actually now have over 60 homes, half, roughly about 30 plus are for women. I'm like, I will find you somewhere to live. I couldn't find her anywhere to live. We were all full up. Just like Mary, there was no room in the inn, and I was gutted. On my day off, I'd broken up for Christmas, and it was my first day of holiday. I knew she was going back to Essex. I was phoning up probation. I was phoning up hostels. I was phoning up anywhere I could to try and find her someone to live. Couldn't find anywhere for her. So this lady would have left. She's vulnerable. She's a victim. She hit the bottle after her abusive situation. She's lost touch with her daughter, and she's now homeless. So this is a situation that is going on in the streets in Peterborough every single day, and behind every single person that is on the streets is a tragic story, a story of relationship breakdown somewhere. Are you with me so far? We take this back to the feeding the 5,000. What would Jesus' response to be like that? As we grow in our love of Jesus, our love for the neighbour will grow, and of course we'd have compassion on him. You with me so far? Yeah, great. So that's kind of how Hope into Action started. We met that guy on the bench. He had nowhere to go, no one to go to. And we thought, why don't the church give this person something? Why aren't the church giving them anywhere to live? What is the point of all this chaffing worship if we're not giving the people on the street somewhere to live? Isaiah 58 says, this is not the kind of worship I'm after. The kind of worship I'm after is one that releases the oppressed, sets the oppressed free, provides the poor wanderer a shelter, provides the hungry with food. This is the kind of worship we are after. And so we said about a few of us had 5 loaves and 3 fish, and we bought a house with them, £30,000. With Breton Baptist Church, we met a guy, we went into the prison, met a guy who had nowhere to go on release, met him at the prison gate, took him to a house, met another guy who's a heroin addict for 8 years, took him into the house, we were off, Hope into Action were up and running, and we had our first house. But it was driven by this desire and this passion to see churches housing the homeless. This is where we are now. We now have 64 homes around 19 towns in the country, some for refugees, some for people in recovery from addiction, some are former prisoners, some who are street homeless, some who are women fleeing domestic violence, some now of people who have been trafficked, and so on and so forth. But the point is this. These homes came from 5 loaves and 2 fish. Jesus has multiplied those first people's faith that, you know what, if we bring what we've got to Jesus, he can turn this into 64 homes. Now, there are 2 things there. One, Jesus has literally, it feels like, created miracles for some of these houses to grow up and running. Who would think that the church can find 64 houses in 8 years? What's happened there, I'll tell you, one, he's found miracles, and 2, other people have had Mars bars that they've not told us about, and that's now coming to the fore to join the party. Does that make sense? I'll tell you about the miracle, first of all. We've been going 3 months. I went and met someone at the council just here. I was really nervous. I didn't know anything I was doing. I was kind of really shy, and she started drilling me with questions about what I was doing. I was like, man, she's so intelligent. I don't know what, she's gonna see straight through me, because I felt a total fraud. 2 months later, she invites me back. She goes, Ed, I'm not a Christian. I don't go to church, and I don't believe in God, but I cannot find the kind of social capital. We'll come back to that in a sec. Anywhere in this city, and what I would like to do is I'd like to give you £44,000, and I persuaded the prison to give you £34,000. She said, would you like it? I said, let me think. Yes, I'd love it, that'd be great, thank you very much. So I walked out the door with £74,000, bought two houses with it. One with your church, and one with, I've forgotten your name, sorry, Rachel. What? That's it. And the other with Kingsgate Church. So we got 2 houses up and running with that money. Now, at that time, the council was slashing budgets left, right and centre. And it was incredible that they found £44,000 for us. A prison never gives money to anyone. People have phoned me up years later and goes, Ed, I've seen you got £34,000 from the prison. I've been working in prisons for about 8 years now. They've never given us 300 quid. How on earth did you get that 34,000? I'm like, do you want me to tell you really? Because I did nothing. I didn't have a relationship with them. So I just fell on my lap. Jesus broke the bread. Also, other people had £30,000 lying around that they weren't talking about. And what has happened is we're saying, do you know what? You can give that money as well. You can invest it in houses for the homeless. And in so doing, the church can provide homes for the homeless. Are you all with me so far? Okay, good. Jesus said, go and see. Just have a think about the money, the financial power of churches in this city. Now, some are rich, some are poor, some are big, some are small. That doesn't matter. But as I was lying awake one night, I thought, I can't be the only one that's got some savings stashed away that I don't talk about. And I began doing some really, really mind-boggling maths. Now, who here is good at maths? We got maths teacher here, and this maths blew my mind. Okay, so this is what I went to. In Peterborough, we have 30 churches, roughly. It's probably more than that, but let's go for 30 because I don't want to exaggerate. Probably on average, we've got average church attendance of 50. Would you say that's fair enough? Not exaggerating there? Some more, some less, but I don't want to over exaggerate. Let's say on average, those 50 people, Kingsgate have got obviously a watch more than that. So let's say on average, those 50 people, let's say they have savings of £5,000. Now, we don't talk about savings. Some won't have that much, some will, but it's reasonable. Assumptions. So how much money is sitting in the bank accounts of Christians in Peterborough? It's up on the screen. Sorry, I just stole your thunder. 7.5 million. If you go and see how much money is in the reserves of churches in this city, I've done a bit of that digging, it blows your mind. Hundreds of thousands of pounds sits in the reserves of churches. You're like, why? What happens if, why is it sitting there? Why can't we get it out? Jesus said, don't store up your money in barns. We kept going. So 30 churches, let's say on average there are 10 people in a church that own a house. I know some do, some don't. But that's a fair assumption. If the average house costs 150,000, then how much is that in house price? How much that? Anyone do that maths? £45 million worth of assets owned by Christians, or houses owned by Christians in this city. Jesus said, go and see. £52 million worth of money. Now, the interesting thing about the story of the 5,000 is this money, I don't think that little boy was the only one who had some food on him. And do you see what I mean? People don't talk about their wealth. They keep it stashed away. If we can unpack that wealth, if we can unlock, if we can undam this, and we take it to the disciples' feet, and we take it to Jesus' feet, and we say, here's what I got. Can we do anything with this, like Andrew? Surely this isn't enough. It can help, can't it? Imagine what God can do with all that money. Next one. The early church in Acts 2 and Acts 4, if you like, is the template for how church should be. That's kind of, a lot of Christians will go back and they'll say, well, this is what they did in Acts 2 and Acts 4, and this is how we should do it, because this is how they did it. So we try and follow the example of those early churches. Hello, what's going on? Got that. Next slide. This is the early church. Just read this first one. No one claimed any of their possessions as their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, they went out and did some really cool stuff for God. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as he had need. This is pretty powerful stuff, isn't it? It's one of those verses you read and you skip over very quickly because you're like, "Blimey, Nora, does God really expect me to do that?" Let's read the next verse very quickly. Mark Twain said, it's not the parts of the Bible I don't understand that bother me, it's the parts of the Bible I do understand. This is what the early church did. This is what we are called to. And it's radical. It's difficult. So let's just focus on that top verse, please. No one claimed any of their possessions as their own. They shared everything they had. When we do that, God will move. It says, with great power they went out and did stuff. And I'm telling you, there are three ways we have great power in the church. I'll finish on this and I'll end. The first one is financial power. I've unpacked that for you already. £52 million worth of assets in our churches, easily. That doesn't include church reserves. Imagine what God can do. If we can unleash that power for the poor, we won't need the council. We won't have to say, go to the council. The council will be saying to us, the council will be saying to the homeless, send them to the churches. We have enormous financial power, which God can use. We have enormous social power as well. There's a story of a guy who was homeless, and he walked into a church, and he kind of had tattoos all over him. He kind of smelt awfully. He had tattered clothes. He was wet through, and he was still high, and it was like he looked a disgrace. And he came in, and he obviously, I don't know why he came to church, and he didn't know where to sit. It was an Anglican church. It was full of people. And he had nowhere to sit, so he kind of looked, came down the aisle like this, and he looked left and he looked right, couldn't find anyone. Nowhere to sit. Everyone looked at him. Middle of the sermon, by the way. So it's all a bit awkward. And he kind of gets to the front, dude here speaking. He just sits down at the front on the floor. This is awkward. And the church warden, who's in his tweed jacket and his tie, he's got a walking stick, he's old now. He's been at the church for 300 years. He gets to the front and he comes down and he sits down and he's walking down like this. Everyone's staring at him. What is going on? And he comes and he just sits down next to this homeless guy and said, carry on. And the guy carried on and just delivered that sermon. Total acceptance. Now, churches, whether we realize it or not, have enormous social power. Nowhere else. Many of us have grown up in church. We take for granted the sociology that exists in church. But where else do you get rich and poor, old and young, black and white, all coming together as one, worshipping as sinners and as saved people in the Lord? It's an incredible social construct. More people go to church on Sunday than do on football on a Saturday. We have something, a community of people that are have an imperative to love others, and it's an incredible social construct, unrivaled in our society. And sociologically, you can't beat it. So you can argue with anyone, say, is there God, isn't there God? Fine. But this social capital is really powerful. That lady from the council said, I'm not a Christian, I don't go to church, but the social capital you've got is really powerful. So we have enormous social power. Power to make people feel welcome, power to make people feel loved, power to make people feel accepted. Remember, the underlying cause of homelessness is a relational deficit, relational poverty. So we have enormous financial power, enormous social power, and the final one is enormous spiritual power. On Friday, I went into a house in Reading, and I met a guy who'd been a drug addict, and he'd been on heroin for at least 10 years. He'd been through rehab, he'd met with this guy called Jesus, and he would now say, Jesus has absolutely transformed my life. I walked in there, he's an ordinary guy, he's not done well in life, I suspect he hasn't got a degree, he's got three kids in another city, never sees, he's not a high flyer. And he said to me, his face was so alive. He gave me a great big hug. He said, this is wonderful. Thank you. Jesus has saved my life. You've saved my life. This house is amazing. Thank you so much for all you've done. His face was so buoyant. It was like he was being transformed. He would say he has been transformed. And that is the spiritual power that we possess. I've worked for secular charities, and I've seen people in no end of stuff. They'll talk about good programs, they'll talk about great service delivery, they'll talk about all this stuff, all of which we should learn from and try and mimic. But what you can't do is beat the power of Jesus, the spiritual power that we have. So, if we're to be like Jesus, if we're to have faith, we are to, one, have compassion on the crowds, two, respond to that by not sending people away, three, take what we have to Jesus. See the church, the function of the church, as to care for the poorest in society. It was there in the disciples' time. It was there on the cross. It was there in the first chapters of Acts. And as we go about, as we go about the rest of our lives as Christians, understand we have financial power, social power, and spiritual power. And may God use us in all of those three things. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's just take a few moments to think about that and see what God might be saying to us, what he might be stirring in our hearts and minds. We're going to move into responding in worship. But we just want to be good to give you a few moments just to really think about that before we just kind of... It's easy just to sort of switch into, right, we'll kind of like... kind of like start singing songs and what have you, and we can move on really quickly from actually what's been stirring in us. So I encourage you just to take a moment, try not to, you know, sort of don't worry about the people around you. Maybe it's good if you can just close your eyes, have a bit of space to yourself physically, and think about where that lands for you, how's that going to affect you tomorrow, when you go to church, if you go to church. How's it going to affect you next week when you're at school, next time you're in town, whatever. Just think about all the different situations of your life and what God might be saying into all of those. Yeah, God, so as we finish off our time tonight, Lord, and just think about those words which we've just sung. If you want to keep them back on the screen, Ethan, because I think they're just a really fitting way for us to finish tonight. Just kind of certainly those words in that verse there, just kind of a great way to finish. In terms of what Ed has been sharing and having God's heart. And so, Lord, I pray that you would kind of take us from this place, lead us to the people that are around us every day. Help us to see with your eyes. Help us not to ever be people who kind of push people away or point them onto someone else, but whatever level of our lives that might be, whether it's someone in our class, whether it is people on the streets and people who are lost and troubled in our communities. We might be the voice in our family or our church which is shouting out and saying, no, we need to do something. We can't act on our own, but we could be the change makers for those people. And give us your courage, give us your boldness, give us your heart to do that, to stand up for those people and to shout for them when people need it. And in that way, Lord, that we would start a wave of compassion and action in our churches, in our communities, in this city, in the towns around. In your name we pray, Jesus. Amen. Thank you, Ed, so much for coming tonight and stirring us, sharing those great stories, unpacking that wonderful story from the scripture as well. And you've really inspired us, so thank you very much, mate. It's always good to have you with us here at The Point. If you want to stay up here for a little while, everyone, you can do. The cafe bit downstairs is probably open by now. If you want to go down there and get stuff to eat and that, you're very welcome to. But if you just want to stay and pray or chat, if you want to chat to Ed briefly before he flies off, I know he'd be happy to do that, whether that's find out more about Hope into Action, or if you want Ed to pray for you, or any of the leaders, there'll be a few of us up here as well. Whether it's about what has been shared tonight or other stuff, we're here for you. So it's been great to see you. God bless.